Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
John Callio, will you go round with me?
Don't fuck with me, fellas!
Oh, I feel so damn sick and dirty, I can't stand it anymore!
I wish I knew how to quit you.
Is butter a crumb?
I had a hunch you might be a real romantic.
We were decoys. He used us as bait. We procured for you.
We could have had a good life together. Fucking real good life. But you didn't want it, Ennis. So what we got now is Brokeback Mountain.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we are spotlighting A Kid Like Jake, the powerful new film from producer Jim Parsons and director Silas Howard. Our guest is A Kid Like Jake screenwriter Daniel Pearl, who developed the script from his similarly titled 2012 stage play. And Gina, this is a really powerful, raw, authentic film, isn't it?
I cried three times and good tears when I watched this film. Do not believe Rotten Tomatoes. It gets a terrible, like, mediocre score on Rotten Tomatoes, which is absolute rubbish. I don't know. I'm just going to go and, like, spam that.
I have to say,
now, this
is the most delicate, nuanced,
beautiful,
and authentic representation that I've ever seen
of parenthood
in relation to trans experience.
But beyond that, I mean, it covers things as miscarriage and infertility and just it is one of the most beautiful, honest portrayals of two parents. And you know
struggling.
What?
Struggling. Two parents struggling.
Well, parents struggle because there is no book that tells you how to parent a child. And here are two parents who love their child immensely and want to do the absolute best for their child and are just trying to deal with what the rest of the world is telling them.
The film stars Claire Danes and Jim Parsons as two parents struggling. They are really struggling with coming to terms with their son's gender identity when they realize that he may be transgender. This really isn't so much about A Kid Like Jake as it is about the two parents.
Jake's parents.
Alex and Greg, and how they deal with their son's gender identity.
Jake's very special. He's always like doing things his own way.
Where are you guys applying?
Oh boy.
Even if we could afford it,
it's a private school.
Even what I want for Jake.
I know we've always said we're not those parents, but
I can't afford to be.
Maybe.
The numbers are ridiculous. You have to remember, everybody wants diversity. Why not talk a little about his gender expansive play? You want him to be somewhere he can thrive, right?
You really don't think it's weird?
I mean, he does like to play dress up. That's not news.
Yeah, he likes fairy tales, but maybe that's not the most critical thing worth mentioning.
He asked why boys can't wear skirts.
I don't want to send him off to kindergarten labeled.
He's only four. What if he starts thinking there's something wrong with him?
Where is my favorite grandson?
I haven't heard from you in over a week.
Yeah, push. Gotta let go. Right?
In a few weeks, we'll visit some new schools, and you should just be yourself.
And that's all that matters, okay? So it's no big deal at all.
Yes. Love is a constant friend.
I'd like to show you something.
There were one or two incidents in class.
And love is a hand to lend.
Kindergarten, it's so hard for a child, you know, who just
what?
There's nothing more.
You two have some choices to make here.
Maybe we should bring him to see someone.
Maybe. The problem is that we started pushing him into this role.
You're the one buying him every princess DVD you can get your hands on. And then freaking out when people start to notice. Is it any wonder he's confused?
Nothing more. Forget everything you thought you knew before.
We try so hard to protect them, but
it's never going to be easy to really see people, especially the ones we love.
Is
one, two, three.
What a powerful film. That is the trailer to A Kid Like Jake. It did screen at the Melbourne International Film Festival in August this year, and we are expecting it.
Queer Screen, I think, just the other month.
Queer Screen up in Sydney. Yeah, just in last Sydney. Night, actually. It rounded out their festival. We are expecting it to have a broader release here in Australia, but no word quite yet on when it will have its release. But we were thrilled to sit down with the screenwriter of this film, Daniel Pearl, and have a chat to him about this magnificent screenplay, because this film really rests on the screenplay. I mean, it is so well written.
Look, it's acting as well. I mean, Claire Danes.
Ugly Cry.
Look, I was kind of nervously wondering what Jim Parsons would bring to it, because, you know, I see Jim Parsons as Sheldon and I can't see past Sheldon. So I did kind of nervously start watching the film going, am I going to be able to remove that
but
Sheldon?
Good.
He's great.
And so is Octavia Spencer is great. I mean, the cast is solid. The script is exceptional. I think Silas has done a really great job with the direction. So I'm thrilled to spotlight this film this evening. But one other thing that we do want to do is have a bit of a chat about the broader kind of political and filmic milieu that this film is situated in, because more and more we're starting to see discussions about the importance of diversity on screen. And one element of that is really trans and gender diverse representation. And that's something we've come to a number of times here on Outtakes. Mm. But I think this film tackles that discourse or situates itself in that discourse very differently.
Well, it's because it's the story of the parents. So we do see the child actor on screen occasionally, and it is some of the most glorious, and as you were saying, handheld camera, really soft.
It kind of evokes this sense of play.
And
gender is play in this film.
Yes, absolutely is play. But those scenes are just so intimate, but it really is the parents' journey. Now, the director, Silas Howard, who is a trans man, who has been directing episodes on Transparent. This is his first feature film.
Yes.
And I think this will open up doors for Silas.
I hope so.
Oh, my God.
Because
it is just such a
world. And for Daniel, the screenwriter.
And for Daniel. I know. Such a young talent.
I know. A bit jealous. Just a bit.
Jealous much.
But we are welcoming into the Outtake studio Miranda Sparks from Joy's own The Gender Agenda. And Miranda, you've graciously decided to join us on tonight's program to help us explore some of these discourses that we're starting to see in Hollywood and the broader kind of more global filmic community about the importance of authentic trans and gender diverse stories.
Oh, once you get me started, I'm never going to stop. So don't even worry about that.
Well, thank you again for joining us. Tell us perhaps to begin a little bit about The Gender Agenda and what kind of drew you to that program.
Well, The Gender Agenda is Joy's Wednesday night live trans, non-binary and gender non-conforming radio show.
8 p.m. every Wednesday.
8 p.m. every Wednesday on the dot till 9 p.m. And then we're taken over by the boys at Hide and Seek.
Ooh.
I
heard there was a dual episode there.
There was a dual episode. It did get a bit saucy. But
I heard it podcasted really well.
So. Yes. No, it got us into the top 10.
Yeah, I saw the stats.
But on The Gender Agenda, we have an ethos to highlight, I know, I guess sometimes the extraordinary nature of trans people, not in so much as, you know, the, talking about, you know, the one-on-one, what is transition, all of that, but actually to show that we live this great range of lives, which is why we love talking to musicians, artists, politicians, anyone who has a story, you know, from our community. We like to bring in and just highlight what they're doing and just showing that, you know, we live these, you know, very, very rich lives, and they're all very different to one another. And, you know, there are as many different kinds of trans people out there as there are people themselves, which I think also makes trans representation very, very difficult as well, because when you're telling a story about a trans character, there might be one or two people who go, yes, that's my story, but there are going to be so many who go, like, no, that doesn't match my experience at all.
And we see that with all films, but I love that you say one of the purposes of The Gender Agenda is to highlight trans and gender diverse stories or gender non-conforming stories, because that's really what the films that we're seeing and we're starting to see.
A lot of them are aiming to
spotlight diverse trans and gender diverse stories. And that wasn't always the case. I mean, traditionally, the way that Hollywood has dealt with trans experience has been quite appalling, hasn't it?
Exploitative, yes. I think, is probably the best word for it.
Got this frightening list in front of me of how far it's come back.
One of the great sort of discussion models I love was written by a trans feminist by the name of Julia Serrano, in which she talks about the two predominant types of trans characters you see on screen. I think it's
the murderesses, I think, one.
No, there's the pathetic transsexual, and then there's the... I'm not sure which one's the... But basically, there are two kinds.
Yeah.
One is the comedy punchline, which, you know, you might see in films like...
Ace Ventura,
The Hangover, mm-hmm. Films like that where, you know, ha, she's got a penis. Mm. And that's the punchline. And it's very, very lowbrow. But there's also the other kind, which is the kind that doesn't, you know, the trans person who doesn't pass very well, the kind of person you're supposed to feel sorry for because their life is so difficult. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, it's, you know, a tragedy. And we never, ever see these characters... either very well fleshed out or with a happy ending.
Mm.
And those are kind of the dominant narratives that we've seen for the majority of modern cinema.
And these are the annoying tropes. And I know, and I've always complained, you know, lesbian cinema, we keep seeing the same dead lesbian depressing tropes on screen.
Although, again, hopefully it starts to change.
But, there, you know, we still see little, you know, glimmers of hope when we see positive stories and see comedies and telling our narrative.
Let me ask you, Miranda. I don't think anyone objectively can disagree that Hollywood has treated trans representation appallingly. Mm-hmm. Trans people have been the kind of butt of the joke for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
How hard is it to deal with that when you're growing up and when Hollywood informs so much of the way we think about ourselves and the way we view culture more broadly?
Well, I've heard stories from others, but I know my own sort of experience growing up, any sort of representation whatsoever, good or bad, I was thirsty for it. Mm. Just to know that this thing was possible. It's like, wait, I can actually be a girl if I want. That's actually a thing.
Mm.
So whether it was a punchline, whether it was pathetic, whether, you know, even, you know, in stories where there were a lot of violence, I would just want to see it, just to know that these people exist in the world. And it wasn't, and I think a lot of people do absorb that kind of message, and, you know, that we do kind of get the idea that somehow we're less deserving or we're deserving of, you know, all of these negative things. And it didn't really take until I transitioned and really started owning my own dignity that I'm like, hey, these narratives are actually really, really toxic. They're not the, you know, quote unquote objective truth of the world. Mm. Because a lot of the time, you know, that, like, when we see violence against trans people on screen, it's just to be edgy, more or less.
Well, we are delving into the world of trans and gender diverse representation this evening with Miranda Sparks from Joy's Own The Gender Agenda as we spotlight A Kid Like Jake, the powerful new film from writer Daniel Pearl. More coming up, including our chat with Daniel Pearl on Outtakes right after this.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we are spotlighting the powerful new film A Kid Like Jake, and we're looking at the broader kind of filmic landscape in which the film is situated. Joining us this evening in the studio is Miranda Sparks from Joy's Own The Gender Agenda. Miranda, thank you for sticking around.
Yeah, no worries.
Can I say that's like saying the gender agenda like five times in a row really difficult.
Oh, it's a heck of a tongue twister, and I think that's what really, like, that's why the name sticks as well, because, you know, like, the gender agenda.
we're talking about trans representation, gender diverse representation, why it's so important. Mm. This is a conversation that we've had on Outtakes a number of times. Gina, not too long ago, we sat down with Jake Graff, who's a trans male actor who's making big waves over in the UK.
Well, Jake is making big waves because Jake is the entire package. So Jake is an actor, writer, director, producer, and has been making short films and hopefully a feature soon, which deal with trans transgender issues and told from that narrative.
Jake was a consultant on The Danish Girl, mm-hmm. which I think really was a kind of watershed moment in the filmic landscape. And I'd be interested, Miranda, to hear what you think about The Danish Girl. Jake is also starring alongside Keira Knightley in Colette, which is hitting cinemas soon. But first, Miranda, I want to play you just a snippet of what Jake had to say about the way that representation has changed and get your thoughts on that.
Sure.
With regards to how the trans sort of, you know, visibility and understanding and acceptance has leapt forward, I think, you know, even a decade is a huge amount. Even if you go back 5 years, you know, things have changed hugely in the last 5 years. You know, the representation even back then was now, I would say, sort of archaic. What's happened in the last 5 years, the evolution has almost been like, you know, the sort of gay rights movement, but kind of on speed. It's ridiculous how quickly things have moved on and how sort of, you know, perceptions have broadened. You know, when I was growing up, the only film I really saw with anyone trans in, I think, was something like Boys Don't Cry.
Yes.
And obviously, you know, that was the most, you know, I cannot imagine anything more upsetting for a young trans guy. But I mean, you know, since then, obviously, we've got beautiful films like The Danish Girl and things like, for instance, Transparent, which are kind of, you know, really pushing for that narrative.
Jake Graff there talking about the way that representation has changed, even in the past few years. Miranda, what's your thoughts on the way that Jake kind of paints that landscape?
Well, you know, I agree to a point. Like, you know, I don't agree with all of his film choices. That's something we'll discuss a little bit later on. But I definitely do think that the way representation is unfolding is definitely... 5 years ago, we weren't having the conversation about trans people actually representing themselves, like, you know, whether in the writer's room, whether behind the camera or actually performing. There were a lot of uneasy comparisons made to blackface, which, you know, is a comparison I don't condone. But, you know, there's still that idea there that it's someone else wearing your experience in a world where it's not been contextualized for the majority of the audience. The larger problem I have with trans representation in film right now is that it's never, ever, ever, and I haven't seen anything to contradict this, that it's not for us as trans people, that all of the representation of ourselves is for a cisgender audience. And it's explaining what our lives are about, and it's about getting that sort of outsider pathos going on. And it's never been a story that's for us, and that's one of the really grating things about media.
If I can speak for a moment as a gay cisgender male,
of course,
I see real value in people who aren't gay seeing stories about gay men on the screen. Put to one side the fact that quite often those stories are played by heterosexual males, which I personally don't have an issue with, and I know that's a whole nother kettle of fish. How do you know, you describe those stories being put out for cisgender people to see, stories about trans people being put out for cisgender people to see as something that's not ideal. Do you think there's a value to cisgender people seeing stories about trans experience?
Definitely. Like, you know, especially when they're honest stories that come from people who've actually lived it. My beef isn't that those stories exist. It's that they're the only flavor of story we ever get to see. I know, for example, just pulling from my personal life, a couple of years ago, I wrote a stage production called Cassandra and the Boy Doll, which played for the Brisbane Anywhere Festival. And it was something that I'd written with someone like myself in mind in the audience. And it was a very strange sort of experience, the sort of feedback I got from that, because every single queer person I knew loved it, but there were all of these outsiders, you know, predominantly older heterosexual cisgender folk who were writing in and saying, like, you know, I don't understand, like, you know, I felt this didn't have enough heart, or it had enough impact, or I didn't feel it was political enough. And I'm just sitting here going, like, show's not for you, dude.
You don't always have to be the audience.
Exactly.
Always.
And that's just, you know, that's just always been my experience as an audience member.
Yeah.
So let me then ask you, just earlier this year, there was quite the scandal in Hollywood when it was announced that Scarlett Johansson was set to take on a trans role in the film Rub and Tug, which has since been scrapped, or shelved at least, and it's certainly not going into production as it was initially intended to do. Now, would you rather have the role played by a cisgender actress like Scarlett Johansson and have the story told? Or if the producers can't find an A-lister actor that they can then secure money against to produce the film, would you have it that the film is then shelved rather than made with a cisgender actor?
I feel like, you know, when it comes to real-life stories as well, because this was based on a real-life gangster, that we do need to be telling those stories more honestly, for starters. So, you know, for starters, casting Scarlett Johansson as a fella who was rather squattish and heavy set as well, you know, was the first thing. That's what got me more than more than the fact that they cast a cis actor in a trans role. And it's also a matter of, you know, just context, and it's what the larger pool looks like. We're in a time where the majority of trans representation on all forms of film and screen are not being played and represented by us. The majority of the narrative is a cisgender actor, a cisgender writer, a cisgender director telling our lives and experience to us for the sake of people like them and not for us. Mm. You know, so there's that sort of element of appropriation in that, especially when there's money involved, especially when it's a big Hollywood project. I would agree with the idea of, you know, get the best actor for the role or get the best, you know, whoever for whatever position. If we lived in the world where there was equity and you had trans people, that we had enough trans stories out there that we could say, oh, yeah, well, this one representation isn't going to tilt the scales against us or anything like that. But that's unfortunately not the world we live in.
And when this broke out, I was following the, you know, the actors that were all tweeting about this because that's the perspective I wanted to hear. So Jamie Clayton, who's in Senses 8, tweeted saying, actors who are trans never get to audition for anything other than roles of trans characters. That's the real issue. We can't even get in the room with you.
But
cast actors who are trans as non-trans actors, I dare you.
Like, you know, there was one recent example. There was the film Anything, which starred Matt Bomer. And there was a lot of heat against that film, casting, you know, a gay cis man as a transgender woman. But one of the stories that came out of that was an actress by the name of Jen Richardson.
Love her.
She is absolutely amazing. Love but her. Here she is, a trans woman who, you know, and she passes fairly well, you know. But she tried out for the role and was turned down because even though she herself was a trans woman, was told
too female,
she didn't look trans enough, which is really telling of the sort of idea of what the public thinks trans looks like.
Mm. Mark Ruffalo, who produces that film, at the time he took to Twitter and wrote, quote, "To the trans community, I hear you. It's wrenching to see you in this pain. I am glad we are having this conversation. It's time. The movie is already shot, and Matt," here Matt Bomer, who plays the trans character, "and Matt poured his heart and soul into this part. Please have a little compassion. We are all learning."
And I believe that's a genuine apology. I do think, though, while I would have liked to have given that apology, like, you know, the credit it deserves, that also rightfully, there are people within the community who are just like, no, like, hard line, just no. This can't happen. You know, like, we've seen it too many times, and we're having this conversation now, even if it is very hardline, whether you like it or not.
Yes.
It's a mixed bag right there.
Well, one film which I think handles these issues, I think, with kind of grace and very, very well is A Kid Like Jake, which is directed by a trans director, stars a gender-diverse young male in the title role, even though it's a minor role.
Is the character of Jake, are they the trans child or the just a child who is ambiguous and folks aren't sure whether they're just
and that's part of the story.
This is the wonderful thing about the film is that we don't actually know and neither do the parents, because Jake is 4 years old and at an age where he can, and he's referred to as he, where he can express himself.
And his parents actually encourage him to just be himself. Mm. And it's not until external people start saying, isn't that a bit unusual? Or shouldn't you be pushing the diversity card to get your child into private school, that the parents go, are we missing something? Are we missing something about our child?
And thus unfolds this narrative. Struggle between the two parents as they try and work together to determine how to think about their son. And it's really beautiful.
Without oppressing them, they want their child to be free to express themselves. So they don't want to be putting any of these other labels that everyone else is bringing into their home onto their child while they're just figuring out what is the best for our child to be their authentic self.
And interestingly enough, when I sat down with Daniel Pearl, the screenwriter of this film, one thing that he did say was that he did want to explore the way that language is used and the way that language can be as detrimental as it can be helpful when people are trying to grapple with these broader questions. Mm. So it is a really powerful film. I think it deals with some of these issues that we've been discussing really, really well. And Miranda, I'd love to hear what you think in response to some of the things that Daniel has to say. So our interview with the screenwriter of A Kid Like Jake, Daniel Pearl, coming up right after this. You are listening to Outtakes on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are listening to Outtakes, the home of queer cinema on Joy 94.9, where this evening we are spotlighting A Kid Like Jake, the powerful new film from director Silas Howard.
He asked once, we were having dinner, and he asked why boys can't wear skirts. You know, because girls can wear pants.
Why'd you tell him?
We told him the truth, I guess, which is there is no good reason, really. But then I mentioned that in Scotland, men wear kilts, which are kind of like skirts. We Google imaged kilts, looked at some pictures, he wasn't very impressed.
So you didn't tell him there are men who do wear dresses in our culture?
Jim Parsons there playing Greg Wheeler, the father of a gender-diverse young male. He's identified as a male in the film. And Octavia Spencer there
playing the lesbian headmaster.
Having this wonderful chat about they're looking at a picture that Jake has drawn, and they're trying to determine Jake's gender identity from the picture. I mean, it's funny in the same way as it is so poignant.
Mm. What that scene also demonstrates is the parents themselves are trying to protect each other.
Yeah.
So
and themselves
because you know they. What Jim Parsons learns in this scene is that these conversations have been happening between the principal and his wife, and he's not been let in on any of these conversations. So he's almost coming late to that formal conversation party.
And that's just, there was the principal's line there where she asked the question, you didn't tell Jake that there are men who wear dresses in our culture, which...
What a line.
And, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, if you can empathize with like, you know, the, you know, sort of cis-centric audience, you know, they're like, oh yeah, I totally forgot about that. Mm. Folks don't go out of their way to think about these things until the question is asked. And so I'm really impressed with that line right there. Mm.
There's a lot to be impressed with this film. Yeah. It is beautiful.
I know, just the trailer alone, I was getting a little bit weepy because I think, you know, as a...
I never cried.
As folks across the rainbow spectrum, there's a lot of us who are just like, why can't I have had parents like that?
This is the thing, you watch this film going, oh, this child, regardless of what their outcome is going to be in the next couple of years, they're so lucky to have these parents.
Mm. Well, Daniel Pearl is the screenwriter of this really powerful and so well written film. I mean, the film really does rest on the writing, and the writing is exceptional. He's fairly new to the writing scene. He's written a couple of plays, Free Fall and also the Plunder, which both received a number of awards, as did A Kid Like Jake, which he wrote for the stage in 2012 and was quickly picked up by Jim Parsons, who produced this film under his new kind of production label. And 5 or 6 years later, here we are with this powerful new film.
Jealous much.
I know.
That's wonderful.
What a talent. Well, it was a thrill to sit down with him and have a chat about this really important new film.
There's nothing more, nothing more. Forget everything.
What actually compelled you to sit down and tell this particular story?
It's interesting because obviously in certain ways the subject matter has become much more timely since I originally wrote the play, or at least it's gotten a lot more attention sort of in the zeitgeist. I started working on the play 2011, 2012, and then it was done in 2013 at Lincoln Center. And there were a couple sources of inspiration for me. I guess I remember reading one article that was just about sort of gender nonconformity when it came to children of younger ages and how that conversation was changing so rapidly even back then. And it was sort of this fascinating terrain for parents, you know, around this age, you know, 4, 5, and 6, when kids are sort of too young to sort of articulate certain things, but they're certainly old enough to start expressing themselves. And it posed sort of interesting challenges. And I guess to me, you know, as someone who went through my own, you know, Cinderella phase when I was that age, you know, but at a very different time, I guess I was sort of struck thinking, you know, wow, you know, that would be a very different conversation, you know, if my parents had been raising me now.
Well, do you think that's for the better or the worse, though?
It's interesting. I think overall, I think it's for the better in the sense that, you know, the more things are examined and the more things are you know, I think the road towards ultimately acceptance, you know, is complicated. And obviously any progression in that direction, I think, is fantastic.
Yeah.
But what I think I was struck by reading a lot of literature on the subject was that in the attempt to be more and more forward-thinking and more progressive and more accepting, we end up creating more and more labels, which then themselves become reductive and need to be rewritten or cast off in some way. So there, it seemed to be this interesting double bind where, yes, I do think, you know, that it's a good thing that these conversations are happening, but it also, you know, I think in certain ways the play was also sort of about the pitfalls of language, you know, because it is tricky when you're talking about children who haven't found their own voice yet. And I think that was sort of what I was most interested in. I felt like I had seen, you know, I was raised in Los Angeles and I'd lived in New York. So I was very lucky to grow up in a world where, you know, there was a relatively little stigma around, you know, being gay and a very sort of forward thinking environment. And I was sort of really interested in what it meant in environments where parents sort of, when frankly they were under a lot of pressure to be politically correct and to be accepting, where that anxiety goes, because of course it's still going to surface, even if it comes from a place of protectiveness and fear. You know, just because you have the right sort of correct, politically correct beliefs doesn't necessarily mean that when it plays out in your own home with your own child, you know, sometimes those things can be at odds. I felt like I had seen stories about children and young adults, you know, sort of growing up in repressive environments, and they needed to sort of revolt against that environment and sort of learn to express themselves. And I think those stories are incredibly important and necessary. But I was sort of almost interested in a world where it wasn't necessarily the external structures that were repressive. It's, you know, it's sort of the internal, you know, conflicts we have, you know, as parents. So I was thinking about that a lot, and I think also another part of it too was my day job until actually relatively recently. I think it was about a year ago that I actually thought was I was a tutor. And I was sort of struck by just the incredible anxiety, you know, parents and particularly mothers felt.
It is interesting because I must say, and I'm not being flippant here, but this is probably the most nuanced and I think delicate rendering of parenting that I've seen in relation to trans experience really ever. I really do think
that means a lot. I really appreciate it.
I wouldn't say it if I didn't mean it. I do think it was so delicate and raw and authentic, but you, of course, you're not a parent. parent, at least as far as I know.
I'm not a parent, and that was I think my biggest fear writing the play, and of course, you know, as a result, the screenplay too, was sort of getting that wrong. Felt really scary as someone.
I bet it did.
Had kids myself. I mean, it's something that, you know, I think about a lot, and something I would very much, you know, I hope to be a parent, but I'm not, and I think it's a funny thing when, you know, people always ask questions about, you know, how much you use your own life versus your own, you know, imagination. I think it's always a funny thing. I think for me, I had one really great teacher back in grad school who I asked about that. And said, you know, God, I'm really scared of getting it wrong or having it be fake. And he said, well, look, you know, because I was talking about not just parenting, but marriage too.
Yeah.
As someone who's not been married. He was like, look, you know, you've been in relationships, you've had parents, and there's always going to be a certain amount of channeling things that you're not aware of having seen or witnessed, you know, that sort of come from your imagination. And I think if you can hook into it emotionally, you sort of have to trust that, you know, these characters are not my parents. But I think one thing that's very similar to Alex, to my mom, was that, you know, having kids was a big sort of life-changing event for her.
Yes.
She stopped working when she had me. I was the first. And I think as a kid, there's something, I think when you know that someone's made that sacrifice, and when you know, you become sort of, the entire world.
Yes.
You know, there is a very special dynamic. And so I think, you know, having grown up, you know, with a mom who was pretty much, I mean, she basically said, I want to be a mom 100% full time. I think having grown up at least, you know, as a child in that kind of family, I guess there was enough sort of, as you say, that kind of raw stuff to draw on, even though the circumstances in the story are quite different. Yeah.
When I went to see the film, I hadn't read too much about it. And just from the title alone.
Oh, great.
I think that's always the best way to see a film.
I think it's so much better, yeah.
I had inferred from the title of the film that I was going to see a film about a kid like Jake. I mean, that is what I expected. And that's not really what this is. I mean, and I understand in the play, Jake wasn't even on stage. There was no Jake. And,
correct.
And here it's not until, you know, I think the first third of the film where we even hear Jake speak.
It's very true. And I think, you know, it certainly bumped some audience members. You know, the title does suggest one thing. I mean, I always felt the film in certain ways is kind of a bait and switch in that regard, that Jake is the nexus, and he's sort of the focal point for all of everything that's happening. But really, it is very much about the parents. I mean, he's definitely not, I mean, certainly not the protagonist. He's in certain ways, he's, you know, I think Silas Howard and I talked a lot about in terms of adapting it. You know, we both felt that, unlike in a play where you're limited to, you know, the play is 11 scenes and it's just four characters. And it's primarily language driven. So you can really get a sense of a kid from hearing about him, which in a film, we both felt that would feel pretty false or sort of contrived to never see him once you're opening up the world. But we also didn't want an audience to feel like they had full access to Jake, because in certain ways, every adult in the story is seeing a slightly different version. That's, you know, so much about the play and the movie, I think, is really about children as, you know, vehicles of interpretation, frankly,
yes.
and projection. And so I think my struggle with the screenplay was wanting to give an audience enough Jake that he felt real, and that we felt like we, you know, had a sense of his kid, and that we weren't withholding or depriving an audience. I think that it sort of needed to enter the world, but also didn't give an audience so much access that they could make up their own mind.
There's nothing more. Nothing more. Forget everything you thought you knew before. There's nothing more. Nothing more. So give it away, 'cause that's what love is for.
Part one of our chat with Daniel Pearl there. Daniel Pearl is the screenwriter of A Kid Like Jake, which is such a powerful, poignant, delicate film. Gina,
I think we both love this film, don't we? Yeah.
It's certainly...
good reason.
I would say it's the best film I've seen this year.
I can assure you, when we know the release date, we will be encouraging and repeatedly the audience to go, because... as I go on about it, you know, we can want people to watch diverse cinema, but we're not going to have any diverse cinema of any type if people don't go when they're at the cinema, because box office makes a huge difference to the people that actually decide what we get to see.
Oh, absolutely.
In cinema. And I can assure you, they are white, cisgendered, straight men who make those decisions.
Allyship people, that's what it's all about.
It is. We need to get out and support
films. I do hope
that's
starting to change, but there's certainly, there can't be any doubt that the dollar drives the films that are made.
It really is.
There's a commercial bottom line here.
But it also, it's what clouds everything else when we try and find these independent films, because they're filled by those kind of
So Gina, tell me, why is the film getting tepid reviews? The Hollywood Reporter called the film a lovely comedy drama.
Comedy drama?
It is a comedy drama.
Really?
It is a funny film. I saw this at MIFF, where it premiered here in Australia, and the audience around me was laughing out loud.
But was
the way
it the
So Amy Landecker, Jim Parsons plays Greg, the father of a kid like Jake, and he's a psychologist, and he has these continuing sessions with Amy Landecker, who of course we know from amongst other things.
Huge crush there.
From Transparent. She plays the daughter, Moira's daughter in Transparent, and she's wonderful in it, but she provides such excellent comic relief in this film.
But it's also that the practice next door is into scream therapy and all that sort of... It's the light relief. It's the exhale of a very heavy film, because, like we said, not only is it the journey of Jake, we don't cover miscarriage and infertility enough in day-to-day discourse, let alone in cinema, and it deals with those heavy topics as well. So those moments are kind of like when I first saw that first scene, I was like, really, are we going to be spending time away from the main story? But then we realized, no, it is that moment of exhale for us to just.
But it's not just that, it's contrast as well, because while this is a story about a kid like Jake, and Jake, there's no doubt, is the nexus of the story. Jake is the kind of driving force of the story. This is really equally a story about relationships and about marriage and about marital breakdown. I mean, this is really about a marital breakdown. We have the film opens with Greg and Alex, Claire Danes and Jim Parsons respectively, in bed together, very cuddly, and kind of ends with them at separate ends of the house. I mean, their relationship deteriorates over the course of the film as they grapple with their son's identity.
No, we don't want to give away a good ending. And that's where Amy comes in and is the comic relief, because she does have that, you know, she's getting ready to separate her partner and it's her breakup that we kind of get to play that story out as well.
Well, we are speaking with Daniel Pearl. Daniel Pearl is the screenwriter of this magnificent new film, and we're chatting about how the film was adapted from his 2012 award-winning play into this powerful new film.
You know, I think we really wanted to keep it sort of a level playing field, so that, you know, as we're watching these different adults, we'll all have slightly different interpretations of what's going on, that we don't come down necessarily saying, oh, I'm absolutely sure based on that scene that Alex is wrong, or Alex is right, or Greg is wrong, or Greg is right. You know, we really wanted to keep it, you know, in certain ways, you could say less satisfying, but I would say more more ambiguous and
emotionally satisfying. I think it's more emotionally satisfying if perhaps less. You're not tying anything up for us neatly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's what's so, you know, in certain ways, I think it's really a story about how we handle situations over which we have no real control, but about which we have to make decisions on a daily basis, even though we don't know the future. We can't predict, you know, it's very easy to throw up your hands and say, oh, I can't control this, so I'm just going to ignore it. You know, when it comes to parenting, you know, of course you have no idea who or what your child is going to grow up to be. You can't see the future. You can't read their mind. But you do have to make a lot of practical decisions, you know, on a day-to-day basis that can have consequences. So I think, it's definitely a snapshot of this moment. Some people always ask, okay, so where will Jake be in, you know, 10 years, 20 years? And the truth is, I think, you know, the film certainly doesn't try to answer that question. I think it's really more about sitting in an uncertain moment, an uncertain time, and sort of coming to terms with that fundamental, very uncomfortable not knowing. That's really the resolution of the film, is Alex, you know, particularly sort of coming to terms with that,
not,
you know, fundamental unease and uncertainty, and sort of accepting that, you know, anything feels so much safer when we can claim to know it 100%. And there's a lot of things that are just more mysterious and unpredictable. But we also got lucky that we had a great kid, Leo James Davis, who plays Jake, was sort of a Jake in real life. He's a wonderful boy who loves princesses and loves sort of beautiful things, and his parents are wonderfully supportive. And you know, Silas Howard, our director, felt very strongly that he did not want to put a kid in a dress who didn't want to wear one.
Yeah, right.
you know, even if it's for pretend, what's the point of forcing a kid to do something they don't actually want to do? You know, so it was very important to him to just cast a kid who felt, you know, sort of authentically like that kid. I mean, he's so young. I mean, he was 5 when we shot the movie. He's 6 now. And I think he's a wonderful actor, but of course there's a limit when a kid is that young to how much they're going to, you know, quote unquote, act.
You've mentioned Silas a few times. How was it working with Silas? Was it, mm-hmm. was it really important? I know, Jim Parsons was very involved in producing, this film. Was it important mm-hmm. to both of you to have a director with trans experience?
You know, it was definitely not, it was not a criterion. I mean, I think it was one of these things where I think the script went out to some directors and, you know, because we had a version of the script and we had Claire Danes and Jim attached to star, and then we went out to directors.
Mm.
And it was a question of getting directors and getting financing and all the different, you know, independent films is such a, you know, it's always such a
minefield.
Sort of puzzle of getting all the pieces to line up. Yeah, such a minefield. And I was biting my nails. I was pretty much a basket case. But no, I think what struck me, I mean, when I first talked to Silas, I loved him because he spoke so thoughtfully and sensitively and intelligently about the material.
Yeah.
It was definitely not, it was never, you know, oh, we need to find a director who happens to be trans. It was sort of an added bonus, you could say. I think his own life experience certainly brought a whole, you know, wealth of experience. And I think he also, you know, as someone who what I was most struck by is actually how much compassion he had for mm-hmm. all the adults struggling with this, mm-hmm. because I think she's had the experience of having relatives and family members who love him and struggled to deal with it and understand what it meant. And so I think he, in certain ways, he's much less, he doesn't have a sort of knee-jerk judgment for people's limitations the way actually I think of people who are not trans but very accepting might actually have been harder on these characters in certain ways. That was actually one thing that I was very struck by, is I think he had such generosity with all these characters, because I think he's seen how hard it can be for families. And I think also, you know, I was really impressed by a lot of his television work too. He'd done brilliant work on Transparent,
yes,
which in certain
absolutely.
Ways is another show that I think totally just is so sensitive in how it handles relationships that are, you know, just as you say, kind of raw and murky and funny and you know, awkward and
complex.
Sort of people stumbling through these conversations. You know, I knew that he wasn't. Yeah, I knew that he wasn't afraid of that, and he didn't have a need to make things overly tidy.
And love is a hand to lend.
Kindergarten, it's so hard for a child, you know, who just
what?
There's nothing more.
You two have some choices to make here.
Maybe we should bring him to see someone.
Maybe. The problem is that we started pushing him into this role.
You're the one buying him every princess DVD you can get your hands on. And then freaking out when people start to notice. Is it any wonder he's confused?
Nothing more. Forget everything you thought you knew before.
We try so hard to protect them, but it's never going to be easy to really see people, especially the ones we love.
Is
one, two, three.
That was our chat with Daniel Pearl, the screenwriter of A Kid Like Jake, which is really a magnificent
Daniel.
New film. And we do need to thank Daniel for joining us on the program this evening. What a thrill to have him join us and chat about this magnificent new piece of work. Mm-hmm. And really authentic. This is authentic representation. This is what we've been asking for.
Oh, I think Miranda would want to see something different on screen, or more of.
Everyone sort of has their own sort of a
barometer,
litmus,
yeah,
of, you know,
exactly.
what makes good representation. I just kind of want to see, I would love to see a film personally where you have a cis actor playing the trans character and all the other supporting characters are cis characters played by trans people. And everyone else, like, you know, from editing to directing to...
You might not have to wait as long as you think.
Really?
Colette, which
Where
is
this sci-fi?
No. Colette, it's the new Keira Knightley film. She's playing a trans character, but which, funnily enough, has gotten no attention. But there are a number of trans actors playing cisgendered characters in the film, including Jake Graff, who we heard from earlier in the program.
This is something I'm actually going to be talking about later in the week because I have run into this story. And honestly, this is, you know, from what I hear whenever I'm talking about representation with people, this is the dream. Trans actors playing cis roles, yes, and not just being shoehorned into this one image of who and what we are.
And then they don't get cast for it anyway. Yeah.
And I think, you know, a lot of us are just sick.
That's not nice, Gina. I'm going to pick you up on that.
Look, I can just say there is a silver lining apparently in Hollywood. So in August of this year, Hollywood agencies, so 45 different agencies, including Casting Society of America, because this usually does fall on casting, which is what, yes, is blamed on this,
yes,
have basically signed an open letter which reads, women, people of colour, people with disabilities and diverse faith groups have made it clear that they want more authentic stories about their lives in films and on TV. Trans people feel the same way. So basically they've put this letter out there that what they want to happen is when a producer or someone goes, oh, I'm just going to cast Scarlett in this trans role, that they'll stop.
Or Eddie. Or Jeffrey.
And think, actually, no, it's not Kira. Okay anymore. And it's the moral code has changed around this. But this is the words that all these agencies have signed to this to be more mindful, because they haven't been mindful.
The Danish Girl with Eddie Redmayne could have been made with a trans actor?
I think it would have been exceptionally brave of a trans actor to transition for a role needed for that part that was written, and they would have needed to be very supported for that.
Well, here's the thing, like, you know, there are a lot of trans actors who are willing to go and do those things without, like, We're just as dedicated to a role as anyone else. Mm. And, you know, that was the really frustrating thing about.
And did they ask? Did they search? Did they try? I don't know.
The director actually said, you know, it's like there are trans actors out there.
Stop.
That was the question they asked. They absolutely were uncertain that there were trans actors in the world. You know, and I got to say,
they can't say that anymore.
Tom Hooper, who directed The Danish Girl, there were trans actors in the film. They weren't playing the key parts.
No.
But they were consults. So Jake Graff, again, Jake was a consultant on the production of The Danish Girl. I guess my question to you, Miranda, as we kind of draw the program to a close, is, yes, there's this wonderful vision of a film that's, and it shouldn't be a joke. I mean, it's not a joke. Like,
no, definitely.
There's no reason why that can't be. But what do you want to see in the immediate future? What will make you feel like you're seeing nuanced and accurate and authentic representation?
A trans character who has agency and is not just a catalyst for everyone else around them. Trans actors actually being in the writer's room and, you know, taking these, you know, lead roles to play trans characters. My personal feeling is that, you know, if you want a big name actor in your transgender theme film, then put a trans actor in front and just get a massive supporting cast, you know, and put the big names behind them. Because that way, you know, you do get to include those big names that you want and you get to push a new actor forward as well.
And that's it. Nothing stops Scarlett from producing the film if she wanted it to. If it was such an important film, she could have got behind it otherwise. That's my controversial takeaway for the evening.
Miranda, thank you so much for joining us this evening. The Gender Agenda, every Wednesday, 8 p.m. What's coming up on this week's program?
Coming up this week, we're talking to Lee and Erin from the Love and Luck podcast. Mm-hmm. They're going to be talking about their really beautiful internet tag team love story, which is it's wonderful.
Well, thank you again, Miranda. Thank you to Daniel Pearl as well for joining us to talk about this brilliant new film, A Kid Like Jake. It did kick off its showings here in Australia at MIFF, the Melbourne International Film Festival, but we'll certainly be keeping everyone abreast of its national release. Mm-hmm. So that's it for another week on Outtakes.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.